windy today.
Oh, it's Thursday.
So am I. Let's go have a drink. Welcome to Brookings Cafe. There's just no telling who might be here today as we venture in to quench our thirst. We call it our Great American Debate. We come to the discussion in the spirit of fairness and an attempt to offer something conclusive. We don't claim to be experts, but we will strive to come to the table prepared to discuss our topic. We are going to extend invitations to those we think may offer an opposing point of view, and in some cases we may extend a challenge to specific people or groups to defend their point of view. Beware we fact-check anything that sounds questionable, and we look dimly on mere opinions that aren't based in knowledge. We are trying to reach some sort of a resolution, something that both sides can settle on as an idea worth promoting.
Hi, everybody. I'm Lee, and I'm hosting the discussion at Brookings Cafe today. We've hosted a discussion on gender relations with women only, with men only, and now the men and women at the same table. Uh-oh, how are we going to survive? Well, here on International Women's Day, we're going to take a look at how men and women see the topic of gender relations when both are sitting at the same table and forced to interact with each other. Like usual, we'll introduce ourselves. I'm Lee.
I'm Ray.
I'm Gina.
I'm Dan.
And I thought we might start off with the continuation of our last couple of talks, because they were all centered on the Me Too movement, which we've talked a lot about. But I'm just wondering if anybody has any further thoughts in these last few weeks since we've done those earlier broadcasts about, you know, how things are evolving in your mind about that movement. Things are developing, certainly, in the media. Any thoughts on that?
It's been a long time coming. I think that it's got more than enough steam that it needs. Maybe not, considering how long that we've had to come. But last time I posed the question of if the ERA was proposed today, would it pass? And I think it would. I think somebody should go ahead and see if they can't push for it, because I know it would still get a lot of resistance from particularly American business, I think, because you start talking about equal rights for women and you're talking about equal pay.
You know, that's one of the things I have to say that more than anything else sticks in my craw, that of all these years, we still can't pass the ERA. Are you kidding me? And actually, I don't totally agree with you, Dan, on that subject, because what I see now is that despite our governmental politics, business, corporations in particular, they're in such competition to satisfy the millennials and other people that feel that quality of life is more important than just material success, that they're trying really hard to make people feel good about where they work. And that's one of the reasons they're coming out, a lot of them, in support of the no-gun movement. Oh, I should say gun reform or some other term like that. So I'm not really sure if I totally agree with you, but gosh, you know, how long do we have to wait to get an ERA? That seems crazy to me.
It's not even on the table anyplace, is it?
Not that I know of.
I think that might be a matter of perspective of our generation. I saw a Doonesbury comic strip recently from the 80s where the father is complaining to the mother that the daughter says she's not a feminist. And the mother says, "Why aren't you a feminist?" And she says, "I don't think women are better than men." And the mother says, "Of course they're not better than men. All we want is to get paid what men get paid, etc." And the daughter says, "Well, duh." You know, and the mother says, "She'll do all right." Because you talk to young people now.
Yeah.
They think it's crazy that jobs were listed for men or for women. They say, "Really? Really?"
Yeah.
I tell them that, you know, in the 50s and 60s, when there would be a woman newscaster, they'd say, she thinks like a man. And they're like, what?
Mm-hmm.
You know? And so maybe the thing, the ERA really, we're beyond that now.
That's a thought. And yet if it's not in the law, what standing do we have when there's some kind of ridiculous exploitation going on?
Well, I could see dotting I's and crossing T's, but for the populace, maybe it's not needed.
I hear you.
Well, are women being paid the same today, generally speaking, all across the board?
No. What is it, 79 cents or something to the dollar?
How do you judge that, though? I mean, my job for X amount of years, and you know, we had a pay scale, and everybody got paid the same, but if you're, I don't know, computer programming like Gina was, how do you judge who's getting paid more, or why a person's getting paid more? Is a woman getting paid more, a man getting paid more because they're more talented? Or is it, I don't know how it works.
Well, I think there is definitely still a trend towards women having the lower paid jobs in general that are not, you know, necessarily the more higher paid sector of employment.
You mean they can't get the higher paid jobs?
Yeah, I mean,
okay.
There's still so many women that are dealing with the traditional roles of you can be a secretary, or you can clean houses, or you can, you know, be some kind of caregiver role one way or another.
It's fun to watch the old movies, isn't it? And see all this stuff going on.
Yes, it is. Yeah, I mean, attitude, you can see, actually, I mean, that just reminded me of when I've caught glimpses of old movies on YouTube or on the television for that matter. But when you look at old movies, you really can see how far we've come in terms of human rights, may not be the right word, but in terms of just general attitudes about things all across the country, everything's changed considerably.
Yeah, even right here on KCIW in beautiful Brookings, Oregon, we have old-time radio, and the Shadows partner, whose name I can't remember, is always the lookout or something not very significant.
Yeah, I never knew his name. I thought he was just the Shadow. But
no, the Shadow has a female partner.
Oh.
Is it? Yeah, Shadow.
Well, I never listened to the Shadow, just the first little intro of it.
Even on KCIW here in beautiful Brookings, Oregon?
Right. No, I listened to the intro, and... And that's about as far as I get with a Shadow.
Okay, so taking this to a slightly different place, you know, it's one thing to say that we are equal and for younger people to stand up for their rights. And you can chime in with me if you think it's true or not, Gina. I think there's a lot of women, young women, who still are so... The paramount thing in their mind is to be appreciated and approved of by men, much more than men are that way about women, and that somehow if you find the right man, then your whole life is solved.
That's a Cinderella fairy tale, is it not?
Yeah. Does that not still live?
I would assume. I don't really know. I need to know more younger women. The women I talk to, I am... amazed at what the lives they're leading, you know, the courage they have to strike out doing non-traditional things, but I can't tell you about their personal lives.
Yeah. I just happened to know a young woman, and she just took off with a guy that she knew for a week, and now everything's going to be ducky and perfect. And somehow I just think she's going to get a bad awakening. But that's a anecdotal story, so it doesn't really count.
She's taken off on her adventure.
That's true.
And we all have to do our own thing and make our own mistakes. And
I think we've all had that type of adventure, haven't we?
Well,
most
I hope
of us
so.
Have.
Well, there's that book called Passages, and... it's an old book, so it probably is, because it's dealing with the fundamental idea that everybody has to go through the terrible twos, and everybody has to go through the whatever the next stage is, and the business of being teenagers is a phase in life that you go through, and
some later than others.
some later than others. And but I mean, men hit 40 and they want an 18-year-old and they want a sports car, just like when they were 18.
A red Corvette.
A red Corvette.
I still remember
exactly.
It.
Exactly. And so people go through these phases all of their life. And one of the things that I look at when I'm looking at my life in the past, I can remember that Cinderella dream kind of a thing, particularly with my first wife. I you know, we were both young. We were both in our early 20s, I think, when we got married. And I remember sitting at the table and the conversation was along the lines of, this is what I expect you to do.
Because you were supposed to be Prince Charming and live up to that?
Yeah, I was supposed to be the man, and so therefore this was my role, and this is everything that I was supposed to do, and she had her role to find the way that she wanted it, etc. But I was really surprised, and we broke up, you know, after 4 years of marriage. It didn't last, and I'm not going to say that I was the wise one in the relationship, and she wasn't. I think we were both young.
Oh, yeah.
And that's characteristic of that particular age. When you're in your teens, you see things totally differently than you do as an adult. And, what's the old saying? Youth is wasted on the young or something like that.
I feel that way anyway.
Years ago, I had an Eskimo foster child who lived with me for several years, and she came to live with us when she was about 8, and more or less on and off lived with us till she was about 18.
Mm-hmm.
And had not lived in a village in all that time, and had lived with white people, and kind of, obviously learned to live the way we did. She married a guy and moved back to the village, and she told me, you know, he got up one morning and says, go get my coffee. And she says, get your own damn coffee. What do you think I am? So I don't know if she caused a rebellion in her village or not, but that didn't last either. She was quickly back in... She left the village shortly thereafter.
Mm-hmm. So I'm sitting with a bunch of married people here. What about gender roles in terms of your home life? Do you feel like it's equally divided? I know when my stepmother retired and my father retired, and she said, you know, you're retired now, but I'm still 100% employed. How about you do 50% of the chores? And he did, which I thought was a good thing. What do you find in your own lives? Do you feel like you've got equality in terms of those kind of burdens?
Jean is the administrator.
I'm the grunt.
Say what?
Yes. Yeah, so administrator is a nicer term, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
Well, I think we should cut this talk off between us two.
Okay,
right now,
we'll leave you off the hook. Dan talk, and
I'll
then
interrupt
you
and
later.
I will say that that's another thing too, is that you run into these cultural paradigms that Teresa is she grew up in a small towns. In a traditional family setting, and her grandmother was like a tremendous cook, and it amazes me the energy that Teresa has, that she just goes in and tackles the kitchen, and I go in and I say, can I help you with this or something like that? She says, yeah, you can get out of the way, and so she views it as that the kitchen's her domain, and this is her domain, and she does this and she does that. And she tends to describe me as the one who fixes stuff. And frankly, I'm happy with that, because I do like being able to fix things.
I'm tired of fixing things.
Well, I am too. I am too. I mean, it used to be I was very energetic and wanted to get this whatever thing hung up or painted or whatever.
I was washing windows the other day, and a little strip of the molding that holds the glass in had come loose, and I said, do I have to fix another thing? And I went into the garage, and I got some caulking and put it in there and stuck it in, and said, oh, okay, and then it came out, it wouldn't hold. And I says, oh, do I have to go back in the garage now and get tape to put... It was just, I'm tired of doing this.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know what it would have cost to pay somebody to do that, but
when I
was ready to do it.
When I think of the number of times that I have fixed toilets in my life, I remember I was trying to explain this to my nephew once, who was, I think he was about 10, 11, something like that at the time, and my sister had suggested that I teach him how to fix a toilet because it would be a handy thing for him to know, and I was saying, you know, the thing I've learned is that you'll be fixing your toilet all of your life. And he just started to cry. And he left the room.
Mm-hmm. Oh, my God.
Now, I think there's a gender gap there. Because you think, how many women could say, I think about the number of times I fixed the toilet in my life. You know.
Some could.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I could do the innards. That's about it.
Mm-hmm.
And we were visiting my brother one time several years ago, and something broke. I don't remember what it was, something had to do with the electric. And I asked him if he had a screwdriver, and he didn't. He said he has a hammer, but he has lots of money. He doesn't have to fix things himself, and doesn't care to. I don't think he knows which part of the nail goes in the board. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and one of the things that I was going to add to that is that I've known and worked with plenty of women during my life who were equally as mechanically adept as I was.
When I do something and it doesn't work, I put an addition on my shop one time, and I wired everything the way I thought it should be, and I turned the lights on, and they went on, and then when I turned them off, it blew a fuse.
Mm-hmm.
And I did that 3 or 4 times and went and got Gina to read the directions. So we got out the... what was it? Electricity made easy or something like that. It wasn't making it easy for me. It made no sense, but...
Yeah,
Gina can read directions and understand them.
And that's part of the discussion, I think, on not just roles, but as far as industry is concerned, 50 years ago, industry was pretty much divided. These were jobs that the women did, and these were jobs that the men did, if the women, in fact, went to work. And, the home... 50 years ago consisted of a man who went out and worked, or maybe a little longer than 50 years ago, and the woman cared for the home. And then, of course, for whatever reasons, more women started working. But it's one of those things where talent has a lot to do with who you finally become and what you're doing. So when women went to the workplace now, to me, it's fairly common to see women who are doing more roles that would be considered traditionally held by men. And I think that's nice, you know, as long as they're happy with what they're doing. I think it's nice as long as it's happy what anybody's doing, regardless of what sex they happen to be.
So how do you feel if there's something that's traditionally a male role and your wife or someone else in your world sort of says, well, I can do that, and kind of, you know, pushes you out of the way a little bit and does it for you as well or better than you could do? And does that feel at all intimidating or dangerous in some way?
No.
As long as it's well or better.
You see these actors on talk shows and they're complaining that their wives gets better roles than they do and makes more money than they do. I have no problem at all with Gina making more money than I do.
And what about, do you feel the same way? Like if your wife or partner makes more money than you, is that cool?
I'm going to refer to my previous marriage, in which my wife generally did make more money than I did. And I didn't feel threatened that she made more money than I did. But there was a flaw in the relationship in that she kind of doled out the money for things that I wanted based on what I considered at the time to be my behavior. And that may not have been it, but that's what it seemed like. And it was like she wanted to hang the curtains up there and I wanted to pave the whatever, and the curtains got hung first. And, you know, we'll see about whether or not if this gets paved.
When we built our house in Alaska, Gina and I we homesteaded and we cleared the land and built our own house. And she had never built a house before, did any carpentry before, and was basically following my lead. But it wasn't uncommon for her to see me making a mistake before it got made. Something was done that didn't make sense. You know, it wasn't uncommon for her to see it and stop me, and I didn't feel threatened by that.
I did feel...
I just said, well, you do the type thing.
I remember from time to time I would be approaching something, but, you know, being a guy, I didn't really necessarily think to go read the instructions again.
Oh, God.
And...
No.
And but there were times when my wife would come over and say, you know, it says in the manual that if you put the pointy end of the nail in, then it'll work better. And I felt kind of stupid. I didn't feel threatened. I didn't feel threatened at all. I just felt like, you know, I should have thought to go read the instructions or whatever. But I was happy and I was pleased that she came over and gave me a little tip that enabled me to fasten the molding in correctly.
You know, I'm reversing that from my point of view. I've always wanted to have a partner who is really good in the kitchen since I'm not.
Here, here.
We'll all vote for that. The Renaissance man that not only does all those wonderful manly things, but he can cook. Yeah. Yes.
And you don't feel threatened when a guy comes
Heck
into the kitchen?
No, I'm so happy. And I love the idea of the teamwork aspect, that if we can cook mm-hmm. something together, to me that's almost like, you know, nirvana, that relationship has that kind of simpatico, that we can somehow dance around each other and make it all happen and get it on the table at the same time. That's wonderful.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of men would complain that, okay, I went into the kitchen and I helped you make meals for the last 3 months, and now you want to go out hunting with me? And the women decline, although
How many guys want to take their wives hunting with them?
Yeah, really?
Well, I know of one relationship where that was the guy's complaint. I like to go camping. I want to go fishing. I want to go do this. I want to do that. And she never wants to go along. And then finally, after like 50 years of marriage or something like that, and I think it was because they were retiring, and she decided, okay, he does the stuff with me that I want to do, so I'll go do the stuff with him that he wants to do. And so she went out there and got rained on and in the cold and everything, and I'm pretty sure she hated it. But
well, what's the old saying about you give a man a fish and you feed him for a day, and you teach a man to fish and you get rid of him for a weekend?
My grandmother, when my grandfather retired, she would give him a shopping list in the morning, and then he'd come in with the groceries and she'd say, I forgot to put butter on the list. You don't mind, do you? And get him out of the house for another hour and a half.
Mm. Yeah, there's all those different aspects of relationships, too, is that, and I think this is probably getting a little far afield from the idea of just this gender relations, but no, it is part of it. It's the give and takes. I can think of just tons of times when I was asked to do something and my first reaction was, no, I don't want to do that. And then my second reaction was, well, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it just wasn't anything that warranted any kind of resistance at all.
It's the kind of attitude that makes it hard on the rest of us.
Oh.
As someone who used to do a lot of counseling with couples, you know, none of this stuff really seemed to be the bones of contention that brought somebody in. Like, everybody had maybe a different way of taking care of these things, and whatever worked for that particular couple seemed to be, you know, just fine. Where I found the gender relations really popping their little ugly heads up was around communication. So often it seemed that the woman was like, well, he won't talk, he won't tell me what he's thinking, but meanwhile she's talking a mile a minute and he doesn't have a chance to say anything. Now I wouldn't ask you to comment on current relationships, but have you experienced that in your lives, that you find there's such a discrepancy in the communications? And both you guys are really good communicators, so, you know, maybe not for you, but boy, we used to see that a lot in my practice.
I just see her smirking when you said that.
The table here.
The reason I'm smirking is because when Ray gets going in a conversation with some other guys and I want to join in, I have to scream my head off to get into the conversation.
She says that as she just walked right into this one without any problem at all. But
well, now, there is...
You're being very polite.
There are some interesting phenomenons that I've discovered, and one of them is... Well, first of all, there's something that is called male answer syndrome, which that's the actual name for it. It's got an official term. And basically, that's the idea that men will answer a question, whether they know the answer or not.
Right.
They will offer an answer, and a lot of times just make it all up as they go along. I have fun doing that. I don't expect anybody to believe me when I make up the answer. I hope to take it to the point where they realize that I'm making it up and we all get a good laugh. But that is a genuine syndrome. And the other is that men and women have different ways of communicating. There are two things that come to my mind. One is that men tend to interrupt. And the other is that men tend to kind of insult one another or prod one another in different ways that men understand and women don't.
Mm-hmm.
And women tend to not necessarily want to discuss something. This is my impression. They don't necessarily want to discuss something, but rather to express themselves. And men, being the horrible listeners that they are, and I know that, you know, lots of times relationships that I was in, I would hear, "We need to talk."
Oh, yeah.
And then I had something I had to do.
That's where you go hide under the bed, right?
That's exactly right. Yeah. Because, no, I didn't want to talk about the relationship. I mean, are you happy? If you're not happy, okay, we'll talk about what you're not happy about. But and with counselors that I've talked with, one of the things that I've discovered is that usually dysfunction tends to be a result of it's not the other person, it's oneself. You say you were a counselor for a number of years. Mm-hmm. So would you?
Well, I really appreciate what you're saying, because my number one way of working with people was to, rather than having going, "Well, he did this and she did that," is to say, "Okay, you can't do anything about what they're doing. All you can do is deal with mm-hmm. what you're doing." And sometimes even do them with individual sessions to work on those things and then bring them back together so that everybody would take responsibility for their part
mm-hmm.
instead of everybody sort of projecting that they're a victim of the other person.
Right.
And that would be really a fundamental consideration of how to work with somebody or a couple.
Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, I think most relationships are not chosen because people are looking at the big picture of how are my habits going to mesh with the other person's habits.
Mm-hmm.
One of the counselors that I went to many years ago described two different kinds of love. There's romantic love, where people meet and they're romantically attracted to one another, and that's the attraction that pulls them together and will hold them together in the short run. But then that gradually gives way to what he termed
the power struggle.
Well, that's part of it, but no, it's a different kind of love, which is really more of respect and consideration,
mm-hmm.
and good relationships that work well. And that's one of the things that I will say about Teresa and I, at least at this point, is that I don't feel like she's necessarily trying to change me in any way to make me conform to something, unlike my first marriage, where mm-hmm. you know, my first wife had these definite ideas about what she wanted me to be. And incidentally, one of the things that I found curious and humorous, after that relationship and the divorce, I went to my church, and the minister there was also a psychologist, and he offered a marriage counseling seminar, which he said first was he did it with the men and then he did it with the women. And he said in both cases, they would say, "Well, why are you telling us?"
Right.
But the title of his series, which I really found interesting, was "What Man Wants Woman to Be and Vice Versa."
Mm-hmm.
And that's what it really all boiled down to.
That's kind of a "men are from Mars and women are from Venus"
yes,
kind of
exactly.
perspective.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a little bit, getting far afield here, but, you know, do you really want to create relationships by having each person act out something that's not nearly as authentic as it could be, because they're so busy pleasing each other. That's kind of like a caretaking contract.
Mm-hmm.
And I think relationships are much more vital and alive and sexy and everything else when people are being authentically who they really are.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you go through a tough period because maybe you don't like who that person really is.
You're going to have a much more lively relationship. I can lay on the couch and watch television all day.
Well, I'm okay with that, but Gina might care. I don't know.
Several years ago, Garrison Keillor did a bit where a man and a woman are driving in a car, and the woman is talking about, you know, we have to talk, and all these things about, well, this and that, and all these serious things about the relationship, and the man is thinking, did I change the oil?
I think
we're due for an oil change.
Yeah. Yeah. There's another story kind of along those lines. We were talking about the mature love stage of relationship, which hopefully we all get to if we can hang in there through the conflict that happens when we realize that that other person in the romantic stage that we thought they were isn't who they really are.
Mm-hmm.
So we fight about that for a while, and then we get to a place where hopefully we accept the person for who they really are,
mm-hmm.
like you were talking about. And the story that I recall was actually, Bill Cosby, before he got into so much trouble, told a story about his parents that they were coming over for dinner, and they're pretty old. And anyway, they ring the doorbell, and he goes and answers the door, and there's Mom standing there, and he says, hi, how are you, all that sort of thing, and where's Dad? And she says, oh, he's in the car. Oh, I'll go get him. No, leave him alone. Well, isn't he coming in? Well, he probably will eventually. Well, you know, and he's having a really hard time understanding that. But the upshot of it is that the wife is perfectly comfortable with going in the house by herself and having dinner with them and letting granddad at this point, sit in the car and do his thing, whatever his thing is. Like, why bother him, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I always thought that was a very cute story.
Well, that's true. And what is it? One of those little books, I don't know what to call them. It's not a self-help book. It's just, I call them those little fluff books.
The ones that are free on Amazon, those guys.
Yeah, probably. And they're along the line of everything that I needed to know. I learned in kindergarten.
Right.
And it's interesting to see the way that a lot of these things treat relationships. And to me, it kind of falls into that Hollywood ideals of what relationships should be.
The romantic fantasy.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
I forgot where I was going with this, but anyway.
Well, I have another story, and it's kind of along the lines of what you were talking about earlier when you were talking about, you know, do I need to change the oil in the car? And it's a story of a couple driving down the Oregon coast on vacation, and they come into a little town, and there's a really cute little restaurant, and the wife says, oh, are you feeling hungry? And he says, no. And she thinks to herself, what a cretin, you know, all I want to do is have a romantic lunch and blah, 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 blah. And, you know, he was just answering the question. He didn't understand that the question was, there's a really neat restaurant. It might be fun to stop and have a romantic lunch and hang out and talk or whatever. So often I think we miss each other because we're not very clear, and we have different styles of communication.
Right.
And men are often very, very direct. If you say, are you hungry?
Mm-hmm.
You don't realize that that means, oh, I want to open up the conversation to discussing what options might be available to us in the next period of time. And he's just thinking, no, I'm not hungry.
Yeah. Yeah. That, I think you're right. That is typically men and women, the way that when men and women don't communicate, but I think it's also true of other people as well, other relationships, friendships between men, friendships between women. It's, you know, communication. There was this friend I had, and I don't remember what part of the country he was from, and it's an exaggeration to say that he talked like Yoda, to say that you know, he would say something and yes it is, or however it is that Yoda approached things. But his phrasing was such so that I could not understand him. And vice versa. He could not understand me when we talked. So he would make a statement and I would look at him kind of funny, and then he would say, well, let's see. It's kind of like, and then he would explain it, and then would it make sense? We were dear friends, but we just were not able to communicate without getting into a lot of talk. And it frustrated us, but we laughed about it a lot. It was really kind of interesting. So I think, you know, there are a lot of language idioms, if you will, stereotypes. People talk in certain ways depending on what part of the country they're from, depending on what country they're from. There are all these cultural things that also come into it, but I think definitely between men and women, it's a real struggle sometimes to be on the same page.
Yeah. I know one thing I remember hearing is that men really enjoy talking to each other when they're walking side by side or doing something together where they're not necessarily facing each other.
Mm-hmm. I get out of breath. I have to sit down to talk. If I'm walking and talking, no, it doesn't work.
Okay.
Used to work, doesn't it anymore?
Well, it used to work, though. I mean, you know what I'm talking about, yeah. Mm-hmm. And women, of course, we love to obsess about our relationships and things a lot, at least in my experience.
So the quality of the sexes we're talking about today is more on a personal level. And I don't know that there's, when I look at in a general level, I'm disappointed. I was very disappointed when man bashing became very popular, mm-hmm. I know 10, 15 years ago, mm-hmm. because to me that just shouted that we were not equal, because only the underling is ever allowed to criticize so openly like that. And by women man bashing, you know, that just said we're not there yet. And maybe it's decreasing now, mm-hmm. you know, that it's okay for women to beat up on men like that verbally. I don't know of any barometer that I could see that would work on a personal level. And maybe because everything on a personal level just has to be that personal, and there's no real telltale sign of how are we doing.
One of the stereotypes of sitcom comedies is the man is the stupid one. The kids are smarter than the husband.
Did you ever read the Berestan Bears or something like that to your kids?
No.
Yeah, it's the father is dumb. The father bear is stupid. He's always doing something.
Well, there's the Simpsons and all kinds of examples of that, right?
Mm-hmm. Which is all a change from the 50s when mm-hmm. father knows best.
But mm-hmm. that was also father didn't know best.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's always screwing up.
But, you know, to get cute. Back to your point a little bit, I think that's one of the things about the Me Too movement that I was hoping to get to tonight, which is, you know, what do we do about false accusations of things? Right now, or at least up till very recently, you know, everybody is so busy jumping on the darn bandwagon, and I worry about things like, what if the guy's just an awkward suitor? What if he doesn't know how to express his interests without being crude or, you know, something else that's horrible? What about the women who still feel that traditional role of, I just have to please him no matter what, or just simply don't know how to say no? I mean, that's a pretty common experience with women that have lived maybe a somewhat sheltered life, that saying no is not an easy thing in any context.
I used to work with a guy who was just awful, all the things he said all the time, and he was just old-fashioned. He's a very bright guy. He was my boss, in fact, and I would be shocked at some of the things he would say to women and about women, and it's just, he was back in the 50s or something, I don't know.
In the dark ages.
We tend to learn from our parents.
Mm-hmm.
And it amazes me how strong that bond is between parents and child, that everything we learn, it really is a hard thing to break, so to speak. There was a friend of mine once who said that generally speaking, most people move a little bit out of their culture, but not very much.
Yeah.
Somebody may grow up a Southern Baptist and become a Presbyterian, but it's not likely that they'll go from being a Southern Baptist to a Buddhist. It does happen, but you know, the chances of it happening are not that good. If you're born into, say, this particular class, the chances, let's say, you know, the lower middle class, you're born into that class, the chances of you being able to really move up a lot are very slim. It's the exceptions that make it to be millionaires who know the secret, et cetera. They're rare. And so generally speaking, it's hard to move from point A to point B because there are all of these intermediate things that you encounter along the way. And I think the biggest of those is breaking the habits of your father and breaking the habits of your mother and learning to live in today, the age today. I mean, that's a difficult thing to do. It's the generation gap, among other things, but it's also a strong cultural gap in that what you were talking about, essentially an abusive type of a person who probably came from an abusive kind of a home.
He didn't think he was being abusive. He thought he was being clever.
Yeah.
Right. And that's the sad part, isn't it? That he just didn't even know any better.
Yeah.
And who's to tell him? So are you folks parents?
I am.
Are you?
I raised three screaming stepchildren.
Okay.
I was the ugly stepfather. Uh-huh.
So as a parent, being raised however you were raised, did you go through like a process of thinking like, am I going to pass on the horrible things that my parent, however inadvertently and innocently, might have passed on to me? How am I going to not pass that on to my kid? And have you thought those kind of thoughts? Is that
not at the time? I think at the time I just felt like I was trapped in this business of trying to keep track of kids. And but it was later on in life, after the kids were all grown up and gone, and they were going through the same problems that I had with them, that I started thinking about this. And then later on in life, when I met my second wife, she adopted, she and her previous husband adopted two kids from the state of Oklahoma, which turned out to be abused, which turned out to be more than a handful. I mean, they were, in some cases, some of the confrontations would get deadly.
Whoa.
You know, knives would come out and threats of I'll kill you, and they were sincere threats.
The joy of it, the joys of adoption.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so thinking about what the kids had gone through from coming from an abused environment to adoption to then being raised in a middle-class environment and then seeing what their behavior and reactions to all of that were about really opened my eyes a lot to the business of parenting and realizing mistakes that I made with my stepkids trying to raise them. But no, I didn't think about it at the time. At the time, I felt like I was really just trying to keep my head above water.
Right.
My ex-wife, when she used to get mad at my son and yell at him, she actually sounded like her mother, took on a New York accent that she didn't have, but her mother did.
Right.
It was like her mother was in the room. So her voice changed to it. She actually sounded like her and yelled the same stupid things.
I see my father and myself
me too.
All the time.
Yeah, I'll say the same for myself, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, me too. I mean, the older I get, the more I see my mother in me, and that's a scary thought.
Well, I'm frankly flattered because I thought my dad was pretty great. Didn't agree with him necessarily about, you know, a whole lot of things, but nonetheless, I thought he was a great guy, and we were great, great friends.
I mean, there's a good parts of all of it, too, right? But when it comes to the things that we wish we weren't being, I think change is very difficult. It just doesn't, you know, you don't just wake up one day and go, well, I think I'll do this differently.
Today is the first day of the rest of my life, and it's going to be totally different.
Yeah,
I think
right?
That's a real fantasy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. So has there been any changes in your personal behavior or attitudes based on all this recent stuff coming up and boiling to the surface, or even just a change in how you see the world, that it's maybe a little bit different than what you thought it was.
I think any changes I've made were many, many years ago.
Yeah.
I don't think anything, these Me Too revelations have done anything for me.
Can you speak to those changes a long time ago?
I don't know, thinking back. I don't think, I was never a type of person who took advantage of somebody. I always always thought that that was, even today, even in movies, if I see that in movies, the movie where there's always like the bad guy chasing the girl or terrorizing the guy, I don't like to watch those movies.
Speaking for myself, just to be a little self-referential here, you know, I think one of the traditional things that I was certainly taught as part of a traditional woman's role was to be so dependent. And I think it's been a lifelong process to sort of get over that. It runs so deep, you know,
these
things
real
that
crippler.
We learn so early,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then to actually learn the skills to not be dependent, as well mm-hmm. as the attitude. That's been a real challenge for many, many years.
Yeah, I've heard that many, many times, that that's probably one of the nastiest things that culture lays on us with this Cinderella syndrome, is that if you're expecting somebody to just come in and make your life happy, mm-hmm. then you have this sad awakening one day when you realize that, no, you in fact have to feed yourself and all of that. And so you're right. I mean, if you go into life early on thinking that somebody else is going to take care of everything for you, and then you discover not, it's a rude awakening for men too, I think mm-hmm. because they also expect mom to take care of them,
right.
and mom's not
it's just
there
a different kind of thing,
yeah
but
and I think that's probably fair to say that that's a failure of a lot of relationships. It's what man wants woman to be and vice versa. The mm-hmm. man expects the woman to be some kind of a mother to him and mm-hmm. take care of all of his needs, and all he has to do is cry and ta-da, nice warm drink will show up. But it doesn't happen that way, and it's the same for women, and so you have to learn this dependence.
Yeah, I know. I was raised in a family where I was told that, oh, you'll never have to work. And it was like work was so beneath what a successful woman was.
Mm-hmm. Well.
So there, on one level, I mean, that came fairly quickly, that, oh, I could have a job and I could be taken seriously as a professional person and all of that. And that took, the first 20 years or whatever to really get that at the bottom. But then there was another level even deeper than that, which was the fantasy that the right relationship would make me happy. Mm-hmm. And that was, the key to happiness was to have that person in my life that was going to make it all work.
The wake up I had with the Me Too movement
mm-hmm.
was that how much I bought into it back then in the 70s when I got into the computer business, mm-hmm. Data processing. In order to be successful, you had to give as well as you took. And the sexual harassment went both directions. And I gave as good as I got, or better. And it makes me...
And when you gave, you meant like, what, making sarcastic jokes and things like that?
Sexual harassment the job.
Okay.
Yeah. And that's the only way that you were protected from getting
to be tough.
Yeah, you had to be tough back.
Mm-hmm.
And I always felt sorry for the women that couldn't do that, And now I feel bad that I took part in that.
Yeah.
But that's how I survived, on the job. You had to be a better programmer than the guys, and you had to give better with the sexual innuendo, etc.
Be one of the boys rather than a sex object. Because it was only those two roles, right?
Oh, I think we played both sides.
Could be.
Really? Is there only those two roles?
Well, back in the day,
Well, okay, yeah, back in the day.
The safe place to be if you weren't being that thing that everybody was pawing at mm-hmm. was to be one of the boys.
At least the older women programmers that got in even before me, they must have gotten in the late 60s, they had to be up on sports. I was so glad I didn't have to do that. They had to stand around talking about football.
Well, where do you think we go from here? I know one of the things that I wonder about is, where do we draw the lines? I mean, okay, I think there's a different set of rules for if there's a power imbalance in any given relationship, whether it's boss-employee or any other kind of power implication, versus friend, social stuff out there in the world that doesn't have a power factor in the mix. But where do we draw those lines? I mean, it seems like it changes so much in different situations, and how do people know what's right where? I mean, I wish there was like a handbook, because, you know, I like the occasional dirty joke. I can enjoy that. I don't want to never hear another dirty joke again for fear that my male friends are going to be like, oh my God, I'm going to get sued, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've talked with a number of people who feel like, to me it's a necessary evil. I've talked with a number of people who say that they think that this whole business is really going overboard to nail Garrison Keillor for something that sounded pretty innocent. Maybe it wasn't quite as innocent as it has been made out on the one side. But I don't put that into the same class that I put the just out and out bully who the Harvey Weinsteins. So, I think. Well, you sent me the survey, and it basically mm-hmm. said like 25% of men went and circled or whatever it was that, you know, they had participated in these kinds of behaviors.
Yeah.
And like you say, I mean, you know, the telling of a dirty joke, a lot of it, you know, you wonder just how far, you know, that is that really all that bad? And it depends on context.
It totally depends on context.
You know, and this is an interesting thing, is that if we were all total strangers, I would not think of reaching over and giving you a hug.
Right.
But once we get to know each other, then there are those people who say, yeah, okay, you know, I like hugs, we'll hug. And there are others who are a little bit more standoffish. And I think it's respecting how people feel and react to things like that. I mean, it's much deeper than that. It's not just hugs and physical contact. It's the whole ball of wax of lewd pictures and innuendos and in some cases just out and out gross. To the point of rape. So where do you draw the line? I think once you cross, you know, when you're participating with anybody, whether it be another a woman or another man or whatever, there are a certain respect that you have to pay people. I've worked for a lot of guys who were just real jerks, mm-hmm. and had no respect for me, had no respect for anybody else, and when I no longer was working for them, I was much happier.
Yeah.
And so those are the kinds of people that my father described it once. They're the kind of people that if you just out and hand them a dollar bill or a $10 bill or 50 or 100, they'll fold it up and stick it in their pocket.
Mm-hmm.
And they won't ask, what's this for? They'll just assume that it's theirs and they'll stick it in their pocket. There are these certain attitudes that come out of cultures and upbringing and so on. But respect has got to be one of those operative words that we have to respect one another for, you know, what's the old golden rule? Treat other people as you would like to be treated. But there are people who are abused, and so they treat people how they want to be abused, which is that they want to be abused. I learned that in psychology 103 or something back there many years ago. It's an interesting thing.
I do think that there's a way that we do teach other people how to treat us. You know, if we don't speak up, I mean, that's an obvious thing. But then there's, you know, on the other side of that is the difference between a bully and a non-bully, or an abuser and a non-abuser, that they are cognizant of the reaction that they're getting,
mm-hmm.
of the person that's across from them. Are they present enough and care enough about the fact that there is a relationship between the two people, mm-hmm. that they respond to those cues? Or do they just bully their way through life without any thoughts and stick the dollar in their pocket?
Mm-hmm.
these are subtle things. I don't know how you put that into legislation.
I don't think you're going to legislate much. I think I really would like to see the ERA come back up.
Yeah.
I think that would settle a lot of problems in a hurry. I think it would create a lot of problems as well. But yeah, I would like to see that happen, and that's something that can be done legislatively. But I think that's one of the things to applaud the Women's March for, is that it is bringing an awareness. There are a lot of men now who are saying, "Well, wait a minute. I'm questioning. Okay, you know, I walk into a room. Do I just casually reach over and grab somebody's arm and say, 'Hey, are you okay?' You know, they might not like being grabbed by the arm necessarily. So, you know, I'm reevaluating my behaviors and,
mm-hmm. and there's a lot of people that don't even like hugs, believe it or not. Mm-hmm. And I shouldn't say that way, because it's perfectly okay to not want to be hugged.
I don't like man hugs. When did that start?
The 80s.
Hey, listen, man. We're just about out of time.
Can we back up beyond that and just forget it?
Let's. I'd hate to cut this short because it's really fun, but we are running out of time. Any last thoughts?
Well, I'd say that I see this Me Too movement and the Women's March as part of the evolution of the improvement of the relations between the sexes. The way I'm very encouraged by the young people who've never heard about the thing about she thinks like a man, or how could they have listed jobs separately by the sexes. This is the way the evolution's going. It's not a new thing, it's a correction, and it's happening right now, and I'm very happy to see it.
Yeah.
And I agree with Jane 100%, of course.
And Teresa's not here, so I can say anything I want to say, except she'll listen to it later, and then I'll catch it. No, we don't get into those kinds of conflicts, so I'm happy to say, and I hope we never do. I one of the things I realized somewhere about third marriage, I think, is that there was a woman that the group of us, all of the friends, we literally rescued this lady from abusive relationship number two, the guy who kidnapped her cat. Mm. And then so we were all sitting around talking one day, and we were talking about how she, for whatever reason, picked abusive relationships.
That happens.
One right after another. She started looking at all of her relationships in high school and college and her marriages, and said, you know, I pick abusive men. That just seems to be the way I do it. And that was a real eye-opener for her, and it took a lot. And so I looked at my own, and I looked back, and I realized that, you know, relationship one, two, and three were really kind of abusive. They were over the line, especially number two was, you know, there was a lot of anger in the relationship. So, anyway, I'm not sure where I was going with this, and we are running out of time, but...
Well, it's a lot of content there that would make an awful lot of sense to have another session about someday.
We're three sessions behind now, so we have to get on the ball and get them on the air.
Well, so that's it for tonight. I want to thank everybody for being here, and my own comment is we're talking here, and I hope we just all keep talking to each other and getting to the bottom of things that way. Thank you all for coming. Thank you all for listening. This was Lee.
Ray.
Gina.
Dan.
KCIW. Thank you.
The opinions expressed here are those of the individual participants. Curry Coast Community Radio takes no position on issues discussed in this program.